they're very concerned about the legal situation in China and what would happen if people were extradited there.
Protests over a proposed extradition law continue in Hong Kong. It's Tuesday, June 11th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, tense accusations in Australian politics. Tough times for some college students. A place for chai. Streaming antibiotics and standing up for comedy. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Hong Kong will proceed with its controversial plan to allow people to be extradited to mainland China to face charges, even after a massive protest on Sunday, according to the city's top leader. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam told reporters that she and her team have not ignored any views expressed on this very important piece of legislation, but thought it was important to push forward regardless. At Sunday's protest, clashes erupted among the police, who estimate 240,000 people attended, as we hear from Aaron Hale in Hong Kong speaking with VOA's Lori London.
There's actually more than that. There were 1 million people, according to organizers. Concern with the bill has been brewing for some time in Hong Kong, but I think it's an international story. It's taken a while to gain momentum. The whole situation is moving very fast. The government introduced this bill only a few months ago, and now it's set to be voted on June 12th. So they're steamrolling it through Legislative Council.
Well, obviously, it must be a big deal if all those people are out there on the streets. What could it mean for people, and why would this bill cause this sort of reaction? What are the major concerns?
So there's historic and then there's the contemporary ones. So something to keep in mind is that a lot of Hong Kong people fled here after the end of World War II from China and then through the Cultural Revolution. So they have a lot of historic mistrust of the current Chinese government. And I think people, you know, I talked to, a lot of them were actually not political, but they're very concerned about the legal situation in China and what would happen if people were extradited there. You know, you had normal people talking about a 99% conviction rate of crimes. They're very aware that China uses, economic crimes to prosecute political dissidents. And they hold that up in contrast to their own city, a former British colony that really has had historically the strongest rule of law in the region. So I think they're really seeing that as a point they take pride in. And I think they're really seeing that they can see that going down the drain.
Are they fearful that literally people could disappear? What would happen if someone was extradited? What kinds of cases would warrant being extradited? I mean, are there a lot of them? Are we talking about actual crimes or more like protesting human rights violations?
So people have disappeared off the streets here. There's the famous case of the booksellers in Causeway Bay. And there were a few notable cases of basically wanted Chinese tycoons being kidnapped by security agents, like from their hotel room here. But the Hong Kong government has said that they keep sort of backpedaling on this. You know, first there wasn't a definition. Then, you know, the American Chamber of Commerce got very upset and they took out certain economic crimes. Then they said it was only for crimes punishable by 3 years in prison. Now it's 7 years in prison, which means pretty serious. But I think what I saw amongst protesters is they just do not trust the Chinese judicial system. And for political-minded people, politicians who are against this, they say, well, you know, it's not written down. The final call is with the chief executive. They don't see the legislature having any kind of, you know, oversight of this. So it's very discretionary.
Did this whole, the enormity of these protests and these people taking to the streets,
yeah,
did that sort of take China, the Chinese government, by surprise? Did it catch them off guard? And are they reacting at all?
They actually had one protest previously at the end of April, and that was only 130,000. I think pretty much everyone in Hong Kong, and probably including China, are taken by surprise by how big this is. By some accounts, it's the biggest protest since 1989 in Hong Kong, so that's in 30 years. But I think Hong Kong people do have a sort of a history and are well known for being extremely well organized and protesting. You know, you had umbrella movement, you had 500,000 people come out against national security legislation in 2003. There was quite a large police protest presence there, and there's also a large police presence in the days leading up to it, so I think they knew that this might happen.
Have they responded at all?
China has not responded yet. That would come from the liaison office. The government has replied. They sent like a message outlet last night basically saying, yes, this protest happened, and trying to reassure people about the law. But they're kind of just sticking to the same line constantly. But I haven't seen anything yet about if they're going to take the bill back. Most protesters, they think it's going to pass anyway. They don't think the government will listen.
It's a pretty big rarity for the government there to actually take heed to that sort of thing, I would imagine.
Yeah, they did once in 2003 when they tried to pass, you know, this legislation that would have brought Hong Kong up to date with Chinese security, national security laws. And they didn't cancel it. They just sort of shelved it indefinitely. So that would be the one case of the current administration listening. But, you know, that was 2003. It's like 16 years ago. We now have a different leadership in Beijing. So people are pretty pessimistic.
The demonstrations are not over as protesters plan to camp tonight outside Legislative Council and picnic on its grounds Wednesday before the bill's second reading. Over 100 businesses say they plan to close to allow their employees to attend. Under the current bill that will proceed with its second reading at Legislative Council Wednesday, Hong Kong will in the future be able to extradite to countries where it lacks a long-term agreement, like mainland China, Macau, and Taiwan. The prospect of extradition to China in particular, which has a substantially different legal system, has alarmed a wide cross-section of Hong Kong, from international business groups to legal societies and pro-democracy parties. Hong Kong is a former British colony granted special autonomy for 50 years after it returned to Chinese sovereignty in 1997. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. U.S. voices concern over erosion of Hong Kong's autonomy from China. Trump threatens new China tariffs. China will treat U.S. drones as move to dent its contested maritime claims. Indonesia warns of further eruptions after volcano spews ash. Hong Kong pushes forward with extradition bill despite protest. Expanded coverage of all these stories and so much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and our website, that's voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. The first ever Chinese-Australian female federal MP is being accused of dirty tactics, including misleading campaign material in the May 18th poll. Gladys Liu, who won the crucial multicultural seat of Chisholm in Victoria for the centre-right government, denies any wrongdoing. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Gladys Liu said her election victory would bring greater diversity to Australian politics. She's the first Chinese-Australian woman to become a member of Federal Parliament's lower chamber, the House of Representatives. However, she could face a by-election against her Chinese-Australian rival, Jennifer Yang, from the opposition Labour Party. It's understood her opponents will argue that Miss Liu's campaign posters were designed to confuse voters into voting for her. But she says she's done nothing wrong.
There were many, many attempts to bring me down through the media, including ABC, including many other media channels. Yes, I feel that there were a lot of nitty-gritties, minor things, or even non-issues, and some lies as well. So the good thing is it has trained me, got me to stay focused.
Miss Liu, a former speech pathologist, was born in Hong Kong and migrated to Australia 30 years ago. Her parents were manual workers in China who moved to Hong Kong in the early 1960s. Ms Liu's Melbourne constituency is one of Australia's most marginal. She won by 1,100 votes. She has courted controversy in the past. In a newspaper interview, she said many Chinese Australians believe same-sex marriage is against normal practice. In December, Pierre Yang, a Chinese-born Labour lawmaker in the Western Australian State Parliament, was forced to tearfully deny press reports that suggested he had links to China's Communist Party. Australia's most high-profile politician with Chinese ancestry is the Labour Senator Penny Wong. She was born in Malaysia to an Australian mother and a Malaysian father of Chinese origin. She moved to Adelaide in South Australia when she was 8. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asian news, officials in Beijing will treat U.S. drone sales approval for Southeast Asia as another effort to dent their claims to the disputed South China Sea, according to experts, and then lash back verbally as well as economically. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. With housing and higher education prices running extremely high, a large number of college students in California are finding themselves homeless and not able to afford even a room in a dorm. To address the problem, a University of California Los Angeles organization run by students opened a homeless shelter to help others who have no place to live. For VOA, Angelina Bagsarian visited the shelter and has this story narrated by Anna Rice.
Maritza Lopez has been working since she can remember. She lived in a small one-bedroom with 9 relatives. Often, she would help her mom clean houses.
I would see specifically her boss's daughters or, like, sons, like, certificate or, like, degrees and everything. And I wanted something different for myself and for my family. And I was like, you know, I don't see myself anywhere if I continue doing the same cycle. So I wanted to break the cycle.
She started college but spent most of her time working to pay for a tiny rental room. The rising rates became more than she could afford. For Lopez, a student shelter helped her survive. Reverend Eric Schaefer, senior pastor at the Mount Olive Lutheran Church, joined forces with UCLA graduates and opened the student shelter in 2016.
Up to 20% of students in California community colleges are homeless. Up to 20% of some of the students that would be most vulnerable, students of single-parent families, gay students have been thrown out by their parents, undocumented students, foreign students have run out of money.
Before coming to the shelter, some students lived in cars, libraries, or in camping tents on sidewalks.
So our students, even in these prestigious colleges like UCLA and USC, they scrape together enough money through scholarships and loans and moms and dads to get to school. They have enough to pay their tuition, but not enough to pay for a place to stay.
The shelter can accommodate 10 students from the age of 18 to 24. They can stay there from 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. They have a shower, a room to study, and volunteers cook dinner each night.
On week. Make dinner for everyone, and then we'll have dinner on one of those tables over there, and we'll all sit down, and this is very meaningful to be able to contribute and, like, make an impact by running something as powerful as a shelter.
The students can stay through the academic year, and the shelter helps them with their first payment on an apartment or shared house. The shelter predicts a return beyond measure.
You know, the student in our shelter might save your life as a doctor someday. They could be anything. They could be your attorney. They could be your pastor. They could be your doctor. They could be your friend, and you're helping them get a start.
With the shelter's help, Lopez was able to rent an apartment of her own. She says a lot of students who find themselves in a difficult situation feel ashamed, but she doesn't. The first in her family to get a college degree, Lopez says she's simply grateful for a chance she would not have gotten otherwise. For Angelina Bogdasaran in Los Angeles, Anna Rice, VOA News.
Coming up, finding happiness with a cup of chai. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. Indonesian officials are warning against the prospect of further eruptions from an active volcano on the island of Sumatra after it emitted a huge column of ash, causing panic among residents. Mount Sinabung, which has seen a spike in activity since 2010, erupted for around 9 minutes Sunday. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the Chai Spot is a cafe in New York City's Little Italy neighborhood that serves a variety of Pakistani chai in very colorful and cozy environment. It's also the spot that brought two people together as husband and wife across two very different cultures and families. Kalita and David think chai cafes could help other people find happiness too. Kalsum Kakar recently visited the Chai Spot.
They are from different parts of the world. Her name is Khalida. She's from Pakistan. David is an Italian-American from Los Angeles, California. The couple had to convince their families to bless their marriage because Khalida's family had religious objections. And according to David, his parents believed in stereotypes that put Pakistanis in a poor light.
How are we going to ever make this understand to our families? How are they ever going to be in on this with us?
Because both responded very badly to the idea.
Yeah. And the we moment knew we told possible. Them it was just, and we couldn't do it without their blessing.
Khalida and David managed to have their families meet.
There were many occasions during the time when we were bringing our families together where they refused to speak with each other. And in those moments, chai was brought to them, and somehow it influenced them. It changed their minds.
It did. It was like ice melted.
The couple tied the knot in 2014 after they convinced their parents to allow the marriage. The idea of chai bringing their families together inspired the two to expand their own horizons.
We decided that, fine, we have come together as husband and wife, but what we are going to do is we are going to bring our worlds together.
Exactly.
Khalida and David have opened two schools in Pakistan and funded multiple projects for women to proceed from their businesses. Of course, their businesses are tied to what originally brought them together, chai cafes.
Coconut milk, the coconut rose? Absolutely. It's a really good one.
They operate one cafe in Arizona and a second cafe in New York City, where they serve hundreds of people from all walks of life.
Yeah, this is, I think, the sixth time I've been here, and I keep bringing people here because the chai is delicious and the ambiance is excellent and everyone has loved it.
It's just the vibe that you have. My culture is represented in this huge city. I feel like that is really amazing.
David says routine lifestyle in America are pushing people further away from one another, but chai can bridge that gap.
Chai is really a beverage about getting to know each
exactly.
other, catching up with people. And that's something that we're actually lacking here in America.
And they hope that their cafes can play a role in bringing people together, much like chai did in bringing together their initially resistant families. Kulsum Kakar, VOA News, New York.
This news from VOA Asia. Demonstrations continued throughout the night in Hong Kong, where hundreds of thousands protested against a controversial extradition bill that would allow suspected criminals to be sent to mainland China for trial. The changes would permit extradition requests from authorities in mainland China, Taiwan, and Macau. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the rivers of the world are full of antibiotics. VOA's Kevin Enix tells us that's the headline of a new survey that sampled rivers all over the world.
John Wilkinson from the University of York and his team of researchers traveled the globe, testing water in 72 countries, looking for traces of 14 common antibiotics. He found the bacteria-killing medicine in 65% of the rivers he tested.
In a few cases, we found that the sort of what we would call the safe level of a concentration of an antibiotic in a river was exceeded by more than 300 times. This particular case was in Bangladesh. And what we're able to identify as some of the causes for this is actually policy related and the way that we dispose of waste.
But where is it all coming from? Wilkinson says it's not clear yet.
It's hard to place a blanket statement over all of these data other than we have been able to pick up some spots where these are quite high concentrations of some of these chemicals.
But armed with this new information of where the antibiotics are located, researchers should now be able to figure out how it's getting into the water and how to stop it.
So really, with the first time now, we're able to say, okay, in this spot, in this river, this is where we might want to go back and investigate in a bit more detail. And we may be able to, by identifying certain drivers of that contamination, be able to pinpoint what we can do about it, which is the next big step.
And doing something about it is a huge priority, because all these antibiotics may be responsible for the rise of drug-resistant bacteria.
So this is really where you're seeing these massive concentrations of some of these chemicals. And in a world today that we live in that's so interconnected, you can bring these bacteria and these potential infections on a plane from Nairobi to London in just a few hours, just being so interconnected the way we are today.
Wilkinson says the places where he found the biggest problems were in Africa and Asia, but that Europe, North and South America also had some antibiotic hotspots, making this, according to Wilkinson, a global problem. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Along with striving for academic excellence, universities across the United States encourage their students to explore their potential and develop interests beyond their major. That's where the Stand-Up Comedy Club at Johns Hopkins University comes in. Faiza El-Masri visited the club and has this story. It's no joke. Faith Lapidus narrates.
Good evening, Johns Hopkins.
It's stand-up comedy night at Johns Hopkins University.
Wow, tough crowd. Is it bad that was the highlight of my set? Because everything's about to go downhill.
These comics are not professionals. They're students, future doctors or lawyers or computer programmers. But tonight, they're funny, they hope. They might be a little bit nervous at the beginning of their set, but they say the experience is invigorating, and they bring laughter to usually busy, often stressed out students. But comedy, says club member Ariella Shua, is serious work.
We workshop, so you go through it. Whoever's reading will read all of their material, and then we'll go joke by joke and say what works and what doesn't. So it starts as an individual project for yourself, and then it becomes like a group effort.
Since joining the stand-up comedy club last year, Shua has become a better observer.
I've started carrying a notebook around with me, in my backpack all the time. And whenever I just have a thought in my head that seems like, oh, like this is strange, or I see something, or I overhear someone saying something really funny, like in the library or something, I just write it down. And then later when I'm trying to write my own sets, I go and I look through that notebook to see if there's anything in there that I can use.
Club president Nicholas Scandura finds writing the most interesting part of being a stand-up comic.
Writing jokes is really fun. It takes a lot of critical thinking, you know. It's like a process when you get from like, this doesn't work to this works. I think there's just sort of a sense of community. You get to meet up every Wednesday and like laugh with people and talk about jokes, which is just sort of a nice, relaxing break.
Sophomore Harry Cooperstein says the club is a natural fit for his funny personality. And stand-up helps him work on the skills he'll need in the future as a neurosurgeon.
Elements of, say, talking to patients as a doctor. And I think that being able to script things or just have jokes, like, ready to go might help kind of smoothen those interactions or make you a better public speaker.
Since joining the club last year, computer science major Alex Heckscher-Gomez has developed his own style of comedy.
Not always tell the truth. Sometimes it's just funnier to go off your imagination, which you can kind of, like, get stuck not doing if you just follow, like, what actually happened. Also, maybe don't always go with your first idea.
Despite the workshops and rewriting and run-throughs, some ideas just aren't funny.
So I'm a current sophomore.
And just because the club members are students performing for their fellow students, Benjamin Montegudo says that doesn't mean the audience cuts them any slack.
If you were performing very bad on stage, we just let the audience throw tomatoes at us to kind of roll with that joke. So we spent our entire budget last year on a big box of foam tomatoes.
So in addition to practicing stand-up, club members get lots of practice dealing with comedy critics. For writer Faiza El-Masri in Baltimore, Maryland, Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Radioactive at Temasek Polytechnic is a radio station in Singapore, and it carries our program. We thank everyone there who has listened today. You can also find our program streaming live on VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. And if you can't catch us live, no problem. Download our program from iTunes and SoundCloud. Either way, We'd like to let you know that our program is directed by Tracy Carter, engineer Nelson Lopes, managing editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team is Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. We thank them all. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day.